We're ready to hear argument now in the case of Pruitt against Moat. Mr. Ferrand.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Bill Ferranti. I'm here this afternoon on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Benjamin Pruitt. Mr. Pruitt reads at an eighth grade level. He does math at a fourth grade level. He has a sixth grade education. Mr. Pruitt was not competent to do a jury trial on his own. There's no dispute in this case about the standard that applies. The only problem is that the district court did not properly apply it. Given the difficulty of the case, did the plaintiff appear to be competent to try it himself? Now, all indications from the record are that Mr. Pruitt was not competent. I'd like to emphasize two points this afternoon. First, jury trials are extremely difficult, and Mr. Pruitt's abilities were not remotely up to the task. Second, Judge Baker never considered whether Mr. Pruitt was competent to try this case alone, nor did the judge focus on the change in circumstances when we got to the point of going to a jury trial. Taking the second point first, the district court entered the same order three times at three very different points in the proceedings. This order does not mention Mr. Pruitt's competence. It says nothing about the case. It says nothing about the pro se plaintiff in particular, nothing about the task at hand. Everything in the case changes from the opening order to the third order except for the order itself. Now, in Gill, for example, the court pointed out it's a mistake. It's an error for the court to just enter the same order again despite the pro se plaintiff presenting new and additional information about his incompetence. That's exactly what happened in this case. The procedural posture evolves. The task facing Mr. Pruitt becomes ever more complicated. The evidence of his limited abilities piles up in the record, and Judge Baker just doesn't focus on this aspect of the 1915.
Why isn't this just a swearing contest between the guard and...
Well, Your Honor, I think that the fact that the trial becomes relatively simple doesn't answer the question whether the claims before the trial were relatively simple. What happens at trial is all of Mr. Pruitt's claims regarding the pre-assault harassment, the post-assault retaliation, for all practical purposes, the claims of deliberate indifference against the other defendants, these basically fall out because Mr. Pruitt isn't competent to present these claims himself. Now, that's not to say that an attorney couldn't have. And from the point of view of the judge ahead of the trial, when he's faced with Mr. Pruitt's motions, the judge should have realized that this isn't just a simple swearing contest. And also, Your Honor, I think that the swearing contest aspect of the case may be the part for which Mr. Pruitt needed counsel most. It's very difficult to get up and win a case in a he said, she said situation where you present the he said and do nothing to elicit any information, any circumstantial information to support your view of events.
Yes. I'm sorry, and it's your position as time went on, the court should have recognized that he needed assistance. Do you think that the district court has a continuing obligation to consider whether to request counsel to aid a person that appears before him?
I do, Your Honor. In the Third Circuit case, Tabron, which we cited in our supplemental briefs, the court explains, relying in part on Seventh Circuit authority, that the judge is obliged to continue to pay attention to the plaintiff's competence and to ensure that the plaintiff is capable of moving the ball forward. And I think that makes sense. We're charging in a situation where you don't have an officer of the court standing on the plaintiff's side of the aisle. We rely on the district court judges to ensure that justice is done. And if it's apparent, as it should have quickly become apparent the day of the trial, and in fact it should have been well apparent to the judge well before trial, that this particular pro se plaintiff can't handle the next phase of the litigation, absolutely, Your Honor. I believe the judge is obliged to request counsel.
Well, what's the legal source of that obligation?
The legal source of the obligation is in 1915 and in the Due Process Clause, Your Honor.
Well, there is no constitutional right implicated here. You have to concede that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. With respect, I wouldn't concede that necessarily. What I would say is that the statutory argument comes so far before we don't need to get near the Constitution. I think in a different case, an argument might be made that to ensure an inmate's access to the courts, which is a constitutional right, we need something like this on the books. Now, that's not an issue. 1915 has been on the books for more than 100 years, and it wasn't taken off the books when Congress reworked the rules governing inmate litigation. So we don't have a constitutional issue in this case.
Well, what in the statute implies a continuing obligation? on the part of the court to monitor the plaintiff's competence to handle the case himself?
I think it's implicit in the due process clause, Your Honor. It's more that this is a right that an indigent litigant has. He has a right to have the district court consider.
That sounds like an argument that Section 1915 is in some sense a statutory civil Gideon, and there isn't any support for that argument, either statutorily or in any of the case law.
Well, Your Honor, I would rely on Tabron as some support under the case law that says the district court does have a continuing obligation to make sure that justice is done and to consider even sua sponte whether the plaintiff needs counsel. But also, I don't think I don't think this case is nearly so difficult, Your Honor. I think it should have been apparent when Mr. Pruitt put his motion on file. This is not a case where we need to rely on the district court acting sua sponte. We have four motions in the record where Mr. Pruitt says, I need help. I can't handle this case by myself. And the district court says no.
Well, so you mean then every time a pro se person indicates they need help, that the judge has an obligation to appoint counsel? You said a moment ago that it was obvious well before the trial began that this was incompetent to represent himself. I don't see that here. I agree that once the trial got going, he dropped the ball, and at that point we had some problems in this trial. But what prompts your statement that well before this trial it was obvious that
Mr. Pruitt,
he couldn't represent himself?
Sorry. Just to clarify, Your Honor, I'm just saying that the district court needs to consider it in every case, not necessarily.
No, but you said well before the trial started it was obvious. And I'm looking at it from the district court is looking at papers. That's all. He's never met this fellow. Why is it obvious well before the trial in this case?
Starting at the very beginning of the litigation, Mr. Pruitt files his claim on Central District of Illinois forms in the Northern District of Illinois. Bad start to the litigation. He files two 1915 motions early on, both of which he copies the instructions from some sort of template into his motion. Rather than answering the instructions, he just writes them in. Confused. He files a jumbled complaint, a complaint that the district court recognized was a mess. He's got attachments in the middle of the complaint. Exhibit 4 to his complaint is his prayer for relief.
He successfully defeated a motion to dismiss the complaint, though, didn't he?
A jailhouse lawyer successfully defeated the motion to dismiss, Your Honor. Mr. Pruitt's motion to dismiss, as it states directly on the pleading, was prepared by a law clerk on behalf of Mr. Pruitt. And I think if you compare that pleading, which is relatively cogent analysis of the legal issues, compare that to the complaint itself and also to Mr. Pruitt's 1915 motions, also to Mr. Pruitt's pretrial order that he prepared, and also to some of the letters that he sent to the district court, the man is incapable of communicating to a large degree.
I have absolutely no doubt that Mr. Pruitt has special limitations. But if we do direct the district courts to make a genuine assessment whether a prisoner can conduct trial, are we essentially going to be saying that once the prisoner gets, regardless of how he gets past them, himself or with a jail lawyer, that he ought to be given counsel?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I don't think we'd be establishing a per se rule. Now, that's not to say that in most cases where an indigent prisoner gets to the point of going to a jury trial, that they probably will need an attorney, and most of the time they will be appointed. But to say that the judicial system should get the right answer in every case isn't to say that a per se rule is being established. Now, for example, if a criminal defendant gets caught on a wire four or five times and the prosecution has four or five incriminating conversations, most of the time that defendant's going to get convicted. It's not a per se rule. It's just it tends to be the right answer. I think we'd have the same situation here. We're only talking about a few cases. Approximately 1% of the cases that get filed get anywhere near a jury. And also we can look at Mr. Pruitt. I don't think the court needs to decide any case other than Mr. Pruitt's case. And this is an exceptionally poorly educated, poorly prepared litigant.
If that were true, counsel, we wouldn't be sitting on bunk. This case is about the legal standards that govern and the standard of review and whether those are properly applied here and what those should be and whether they need revisiting.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And there's no dispute among the parties, at least about the legal standard. And Mr. Pruitt, we would agree that the legal standard established in Farmer, the standard itself, given the difficulty of the case, we consider the competence of the pro se litigant to handle the litigation. That's the appropriate standard. Deferring to the district court is appropriate.
Could you summarize then, in considering the competence of the pro se plaintiff, if, as I think it's quite clear on both sides, no one's arguing that pro se people always get a lawyer, pro se people never get a lawyer, anything like that, in order to provide this kind of guidance for the future, we need to tell the district courts what should be the triggers for appointing a lawyer. And you've said poor ability to communicate is one. Is there anything else?
Yes, Your Honor. I think as far as the competence aspect of the inquiry, what we highlighted in our supplemental brief, and it mirrors what the Third Circuit, which has set out criteria for competence, we need to look at the education of the litigant, if they have any other experience that would suggest an ability to litigate the case.
What about the following? Suppose if you have a jury trial, we know it's difficult to conduct a jury trial, and you know that the person has virtually no education, say sixth grade education. Couldn't the judge have a little, I wouldn't call it a competence hearing, but couldn't he, it wouldn't have to be in person, but couldn't he interview the fellow, you know, video conference or something if it's a prisoner? Ask him a few questions just to see whether, he in fact has a kind of articulateness or experience that would enable him to handle the trial. Has that ever been done? Do we have any cases in which the judge decided, yeah, I there's enough doubt here, I should talk to this person. I should ask him a few questions before deciding whether to try to find a lawyer for
it. I don't know of any case where that's been done in particular, Your Honor, but I assume that some of the district courts, that each individual judge probably has their own practice for how they would go about handling these cases, especially when they're coming up on a jury trial. But I think one thing that could be emphasized for the district court judges is to focus on, as you suggest, the individual litigant in front of them.
Mr. Ferranti, I wonder, though, whether that didn't occur in this case. We know there were two conferences at which the plaintiff participated by video from the prison. Do we know what happened during those conferences?
Not at all, Your Honor. There's no indication in the record what happened
at
the conference.
Doesn't that make it difficult for you as the appellee? Nothing of that has been put in the record. Sorry, as the appellant. Nothing of that has been put in the record. And for all we know, the judge had a tete-a-tete with the plaintiff and made a reasoned judgment. He may not have written it down, but he may well have done everything.
Nothing has been put in the record because there's nothing to put in the record. And that, Your Honor, I would respectfully submit should be held against Judge Baker. When a district court makes a discretionary decision, they have an obligation to ensure that there's a record that will enable this court to review that decision.
Also, so if Judge Baker had said, I watched the video conferences and I'm satisfied that Mr. Pruitt, while not perfect, can handle himself, you wouldn't be here?
We would still be here, Your Honor, but it would be a more difficult case because we'd be confronting
the judgment.
We would be confronting the judgment of, as this court has recognized, a very seasoned district court judge with a lot of experience. I think the problem here is that the judge didn't grapple with the issue, and if he had, I don't think that, actually we probably wouldn't be here because I think he would have gotten the right answer. Because there's only one reasonable answer in this case. Mr. Pruitt couldn't handle a jury trial.
Now, you mentioned the Farmer versus Haas case, and I assume you think that's the right test, or are you suggesting that we modify it in any way?
I would suggest a formal modification, perhaps some encouragement to the district courts to consider a couple things more specifically. That is, the particular plaintiff, not some sort of everyman pro se plaintiff, which I think is where Judge Baker, maybe to the extent he considered competence at all, got off on the wrong track, and also to consider carefully the next phase in the litigation. Judge Baker decided very early on that Mr. Pruitt's claims were not particularly complicated. Now, an order that might have sufficed at the motion to dismiss stage does not suffice. The analysis nor the order suffices at the summary judgment stage, much less when you're heading into a trial. I think this court could appropriately consider the district court's, sorry, encourage the district courts to consider consciously, self-consciously, the next phase of the trial and whether the pro se litigant needs help.
Can we take into consideration the extensive experience of Judge Baker?
Yes, Your Honor, except that I'm sorry, let me take that back. In this case, I don't think you can, Your Honor, because I don't think he brought that to bear on Mr. Pruitt and on Mr. Pruitt's request for counsel. It's attention to context that justifies deferring to a district court judge. And in this situation, the district court judge just did not root his decision in the context of the case.
So we should give more deference to a judge who's been on the bench longer than a judge who has not?
No, Your Honor. I don't think that at all. I think we defer.
Do we give more deference to a judge who has a, quote, reputation, unquote, to one who does not?
No, Your Honor. I think we defer to the district court judges, one equal to the other.
Then would you like to revise your answer to Judge King?
I'm sorry, I missed where I went astray, Your Honor.
I believe the judge asked you whether or not the judge's reputation could be considered in determining.
I apologize. I misspoke. I don't think that we need to. I don't think it's appropriate to consider the judge's reputation either way. I think what you can do is consider the order that the judge made in the particular case and the facts of the case and the record on which that order is based.
Star quality doesn't count.
No, Your Honor.
What's on the record counts.
Pardon?
What's on the record counts.
What's on the record counts, exactly. Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me ask you a question. About four of the judges here have been in the district court before we were fortunate enough to move to this court. The district court judge cannot appoint a lawyer in a case like this. He can solicit or request lawyers to take the case. What if, hypothetically, the judge here, Judge Baker, had thought of calling one or two, maybe three lawyers, and all had declined to take the case? How many lawyers would he have to contact? Would he have to keep doing it until a lawyer agreed to take the case?
Under the rules, the local rules of each district, the bar has an obligation to take these cases.
Oh, the bar has an obligation to consider taking the cases, but not to do that. A case that I don't know that a lot of lawyers would want to take this case.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think the amicus brief that was filed at the supplemental briefing stage indicates that there are quite a few attorneys
The principle is important, but the case here, I mean, the jury was out 27 minutes when they decided this case, and maybe that was because he didn't have a lawyer. You could argue that.
But I think it's precisely because of that, Your Honor.
Are you going to represent him if this judgment is set aside?
That's my plan, Your Honor.
Could all of this be alleviated by a list of those lawyers willing to take such cases, an organization known as We Take Pro Se Prisoners?
It could, Your Honor. And there's a local rule in the Southern District of Indiana where that district has done just that. They've assembled a voluntary list that organizations and attorneys can put themselves on volunteering to be considered for these sorts of cases.
So, can we go home now?
And in the Northern District of Illinois, with the trial bar program, when lawyers become members of the trial bar, they agree to take a pro se case on an annual basis. So that's another alternative, and that's alleviated a lot of this problem in the Northern District of Illinois.
Does the size of the bar in the Central District of Illinois make any difference?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it would. I think we need to focus on the rights of the individual litigant. And if we get a case where the district court judge thinks that an appointment is appropriate and can't find an attorney to take it, then I think we have a hard case. But we don't have that hard case here.
What happened with the Chicago Bar Association referral?
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know if Mr. Pruitt followed up on that. There's some question about whether that was actually a referral that was made for this case. It's for an entertainment lawyer, so it's not clear that referral was made for this case as opposed to something else. But his efforts to appoint counsel are not an issue. They've never been challenged.
Let me ask you another question. Is it your position that every time a district court fails to expressly consider the plaintiff's competence, that would be an abuse of discretion?
Yes, sir.
So even if you had a pro se litigant who was, say, a disbarred lawyer, you would say that applied?
I would say that the district court judge has an obligation to at least consider it.
So But my question is whether it was an abuse of discretion, just an automatic, if the court fails to consider the competency prong. And if it so happened that the pro se was a disbarred lawyer, would that be an abuse of discretion?
It would, but it would be harmless.
But it sounds to me implicitly that you're also arguing not just for a substantive rule in the district court that both competence and the complexity or lack thereof of the case be considered, but also a procedural requirement that the district court articulate on the record why the motion to have counsel was either granted or denied. Is that the case?
I don't think we're asking for anything new. I think this is standard abuse of discretion law. The problem here is just the district court has to give us enough to infer from the record that he exercised his discretion in light of the legal standard, and we don't have that.
Can you give us an example of what the district judge should ask?
I'm sorry.
Specifically, can you give us an example of what the district judge should have to make this determination?
I'm not saying he necessarily should have asked Mr. Pruitt face-to-face. He could have had a conversation about anything. And based on Mr. Pruitt's performance on his feet at trial, I think it would have become clear very quickly to the district court judge that Mr. Pruitt was incompetent.
Well, but if you're asking us to adopt some rule, what should the judges ask to meet your standard?
Given the difficulty of the case, is this plaintiff competent to try it by himself? Based on his education, training, experience, conduct of the litigation to date, and any other special circumstances suggested by the facts of the case, Your Honor.
Suggested by what?
By the particular facts of the case. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Ferrandi, we asked you a lot of questions, so I will give you 2 extra minutes for rebuttal, and you can prepare for that.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Illinois Assistant Attorney General Carl Elitz for the Illinois State Defendants. May it please the Court. Your Honor, it's my contention, of course, that this case should be affirmed because Judge Baker did not abuse his discretion in deciding to deny Mr. Pruitt's request for counsel.
Mr. Elitz, how do we know that? I mean, there are a lot of areas where we state for purposes of any kind of meaningful appellate review, we need an explanation of some kind from the district court judge. It doesn't have to be a long essay, but just some kind of assurance that the district court has touched the bases that the legal standard requires. And here, we don't see a word from the district judge about Mr. Pruitt's competence. We see mentions about the complexity of the case only. So how can we be confident that he did exercise his discretion?
Your Honor, it's my contention that complexity and competence are really two sides of the same coin.
But they aren't. I mean, suppose he had an IQ of 50, you know, just to take an extreme case. I don't see that in this record. But if competence and complexity are really two sides of the same coin, you would require the man with the IQ of 50 to try his own case.
Depending on that's certainly an extreme case.
Well, I'm trying to see, are these actually different standards?
But there are harder and easier cases. And
so you would agree that they really are, in fact, different standards?
Competence?
Right.
I think they work actually hand in hand. You can't really talk intelligently about competence without knowing what the complexity
is. Well, that's the point.
I'm sorry, Your Honors. I don't mean to.
You just did, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, because even a fairly simple case for the person with the IQ of 50 would probably be impossible to try.
At some point, a plaintiff is simply, or any litigant, is simply not competent to go
right
forward and needs a lawyer. There is some place that way.
Okay.
Of course, it's my position that this is not that case.
That's a different point, then. And then that takes me back to my other question, though. How can we be sure, since, frankly, reading the transcript of this trial and looking at the complaint and looking at the pretrial things, Mr. Pruitt certainly seems to have severe limitations?
Well, Mr. Pruitt, I think, did a job in this trial that was adequate to comport with due process. That's the second part of my argument. I think that would be enough to affirm the district court.
That's a separate issue. Are you suggesting, so if a person has an IQ of 50, he's retarded. So are you suggesting that if he's not retarded, the only thing the judge has to look at is the complexity of the case. Is that your position?
His abilities, his mental abilities.
Is that your position?
I'm sorry, Judge, please repeat.
If the plaintiff is not retarded, then is the only issue that the judge is required to consider is the complexity of the case.
No, there may be other things that would suggest a need for counsel, and there are many cases like that.
Well, in this case...
Like what? I don't understand.
He may be blind and be unable to cross-examine medical witnesses that he needs
to. That's extremely esoteric. Yeah. Suppose this person, he is not retarded, he has no disabilities, mental or physical. Is it then your proposition that the only thing the judge has to consider is the complexity of the case?
No, he needs to consider the individual who's before him, Your Honor. I think that's the position we've taken. And
then
I
don't understand your answer to Judge Wolf. I don't know. I don't think you know what your position is. Blunt.
I believe the competency and complexity are subjective factors. Now, at the extreme,
they
work together. A case that becomes more and more...
Working together is not... That's not what subjective means. You've lost me completely.
As the case becomes more and more difficult, it becomes incumbent upon... The question becomes whether this plaintiff can come up to that level...
Who is subjectivity? Whose subjectivity are you talking about? The judge? The plaintiff?
What I'm saying is we don't use a reasonable man standard to judge the case.
Well, in knowing here, maybe we can get to it this way. Knowing of Mr. Pruitt's educational level and having seen the difficulty that he had writing pleadings, putting aside that, you know, the jailhouse lawyer, what reason would a judge have? What reason would a judge have to think that that this person could try a case? What reason would Judge Baker have said, "Aha! I've got a guy here who can try this case."
This case was, and I know that there's some disagreement about this in the panel decision, but this case was a simple and fairly easy case to try, as cases go.
Even considering the subject matter, I mean, how could a case involving that kind of physical, personal, uncomfortable, embarrassing situation ever be an easy case to try?
I think it depends on our plaintiff. If our plaintiff is someone who shows sensitivity and a difficulty in trying that kind of case, then that's a factor that should reasonably be considered. But here we don't have any of that. And in fact, Judge, when we look at the trial...
How can one tell, though, without knowing what was in the two video conferences? Were they preserved in any way? Do they exist on videotape?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I haven't heard any references to anything like that in
Doesn't the judge have an obligation to preserve in some way all proceedings held in court?
I'm not sure that that proceeding was videotaped, Your Honor. It was a live proceeding.
What do you mean a live video?
It was a video.
It's a live video. Doesn't the court have an obligation to preserve, if not the video itself, by making a recording, at least a transcript of it? I thought the Court Reporters Act, 753, required all proceedings to be recorded so that we don't have problems like this, in part. Maybe we need copies for the future. Maybe we need copies of these kinds of things. One of the puzzles is that many of the things that are being talked about here may or may not have been done during those proceedings. And in fact, the judge may or may not have made findings during the video conference that are relevant.
Can I just correct something that my opponent had said here? We know that there was some substantive order that was entered after one of the video conferences because the pretrial order that the attorney generals had tendered to the court was modified by the court to change language that suggested that the trial was only going to be about something that happened on August 2nd. Which was the touching that became the centerpiece of the trial. Judge Baker took that out of the pretrial order after that video conference. I'm not sure if it was the first one or the second one. So it's incorrect to say that it was just a pro forma conference. Something happened there, and I guess I have to agree with you, something happened. I don't know whether the Court Reporters Act would require it to be recorded. I don't know that there's been a tape, though, Your Honors. Simply because there's been a video transmission doesn't mean there's been a recording made. I don't know whether there's a recording made or not when prisoners appear closed circuit like that. I think it's a live back and forth.
But that's in part where my question comes from. The idea is that the closed circuit TV is a substitute for having the prisoner present in the flesh. But everybody agrees if the prisoner had been present in the flesh, there would be a court reporter there, and we would know exactly what happened.
Yes, I don't know whether there was a court reporter or not, so I apologize for that, and perhaps I can find out.
The point is that probably wouldn't make any difference since there was no comment by the district court on what that meant in terms of the competency of the pro se. Because all we've got are three boilerplate identical orders. I mean, you said the court's decision should be tailored to the particular defendant, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and there's nothing in that any of those orders that are tailored to him other than that general language, right?
Well, the language is not, you know, that language, in my view, was written for this case. I went back and I looked at Judge Baker's other orders, for example, in the Johnson case, and it wasn't the same language.
Well, it's the three identical. He uses the same language for each of the three orders, and he doesn't mention at all anything about competence.
Orders did not change. The first time he ruled, there was not on file the statements by Mr. Pruitt that he had sought outside counsel, so I don't think that even comes up. It really only comes up just before the trial, because up until that point, Mr. Pruitt had been successful in
right,
litigation.
Right, but then right before the third time he rejects them, he tells them all about his educational, and the order remains the same. So, I mean, at the very least, the court should have addressed his educational level. Don't you agree? I mean, if it's supposed to be tailored.
Not necessarily his educational level, because I don't know that Judge...
Well, his comprehension level. I mean, the things that he raised, we don't have anything.
Some clue about him. You can look at this order, and this could have been a case about the prison cells being too cold. It could have been a case about a doctor not giving proper treatment. It just says neither the legal issues raised in the complaint nor the evidence that might support the plaintiff's claims are so complex or intricate that a trained attorney is necessary.
That's
boilerplate. I mean,
time, Judge Baker had also entered an order not dismissing the case and explaining that he had gone through the complaint. It was
in
very
a different
specific.
Context.
But it was very specific, and it showed Judge Baker had gone through Mr. Pruitt's complaint very carefully, pointing out section by section, this is relevant, this is not relevant. So, and that's something that Mr. Pruitt drafted.
Well,
so Judge Baker had that background. I know you're asking a slightly different question.
It's a different question, and actually I want to come at part of the question Judge Easterbrook was asking you about a minute ago. We are forced to be reading some pretty obscure tea leaves about what Judge Baker was thinking about, and I refer you to a comment in our Farmer versus Haas decision where the court draws an inference from the way Farmer was handling the trial that back before the trial, the district judge reasonably saw Farmer as a fairly shrewd litigator. The transcript of the trial discloses a shrewd cross-examination. And so if you're trying to guess what was the district judge thinking at the relevant time, that is the time the motions were presented, in this case, goodness, if we look at this trial transcript, Mr. Pruitt either had a remarkable change of capability or back when the trial judge was considering the appointment motion, Pruitt was also not very competent.
There's a premise in your statements, though, Judge, that I just really disagree with, which is that that Mr. Pruitt wasn't able to put on a competent case.
That's how I read this transcript, to tell you the truth, because he keeps saying, I don't know what I'm doing. He doesn't have eight of his witnesses. He doesn't have documents.
The place where he really shined was when he cross-examined Officer Mirisch.
Oh, no, you're kidding.
No,
that's not.
I honestly believe that.
That's not how I read that. He asks a few questions.
He got no, but that's what any cross-examination
no.
So seriously, that one cross-examination saves his performance.
No,
I mean,
but it shows that someone who is not educated and doesn't speak eloquently, with the help of the trial judge, can pull it together and can proceed in a way that and have a trial.
No, it doesn't actually.
Speaking about the help of a trial judge, there's no question here that a Judge Baker did try to help him here and there, but a trial judge can't you know, map out strategy. A trial judge can't tell the plaintiff whom to call. And bottom line, he can't be the plaintiff's advocate. That's not our system.
Yes.
So,
but Mr. Pruitt doesn't have a constitutional right to an attorney.
We're not talking about the Constitution.
Or a statutory right. His right to counsel is there to make sure his trial doesn't fall below minimum standards of due process. And that's the real test. Did this trial fall below minimum standards of due process?
Well, yes. let me ask you.
Yes. There it is. Okay.
I don't think I can win if that's going to be the answer, but I think it was. Well, actually, no, I want to take that back. Obviously, we have to go back and look and see whether there was an abuse of discretion, too.
Right.
But anyway.
But why wouldn't a sensible rule be that a district judge has 400, 500 cases on the docket and in the real world can't devote an extraordinary amount of time to determine the competency of somebody like this. So a rule that would say, okay, we will determine that there was no abuse of discretion in the initial decision not to appoint attorney. Now the case goes to trial, and after a half a day or something, it becomes pretty obvious to everybody that this fella is not competent to proceed. A rule that would require a revisiting of that decision not to recruit a lawyer when it becomes obvious in the trial. Now, I know you can disagree. You can say it wasn't obvious during this trial, but if it is.
The problem with that rule would be it would put a premium on incompetence. It would set up a system
on incompetence.
As the litigation proceeds and it becomes.
I mean, a highly competent person. Would, when it came to the trial, he would simulate incompetence?
No, what I'm saying is that it would become clear to the pro se bar that when things got bad at trial, giving up was the way to go.
But, you know, I'm baffled.
Then you could get an attorney perhaps afterwards.
I think the judge could be wise enough to know when you're trying to pull the wool over his eyes by faking incompetence or something. But, I mean, it's real genuine. I mean, this transcript is pretty awful, I think.
Mr. Ellis, I'm just a little bit baffled that the state is so opposed to the idea that a few more lawyers might be appointed, because certainly at this court, when I think of the cases we have with pro ses versus those with lawyers, we can resolve them more quickly, more efficiently. I don't know that results change that much. It's just that it gets organized better. It's very odd to me. And I'm asking you to take a longer view.
Okay.
Yes, here's this case. I know you want to have, you know, your judgment. But in the long run, why wouldn't the state also be assisted by a rule that said, state on the record why you think this person is competent or not. You know, until we see some problem with the bar turning things down, open the door a little bit more to appointment of lawyers.
In a prospective rule, Your Honor, I don't think I have a problem with that. It's just that that wasn't the rule that Judge Baker faced, and it was, and I think that the order that Judge Baker entered complied with.
But the reason we sit on bunk is to set rules prospectively. It sounds like you and the plaintiff are now on the same side of the table.
The defense has never argued that we were against Mr. Pruitt having counsel. We just believe that the trial that Mr. Pruitt got was a fair one, given that there's a very low standard.
You know, when you talk about a new rule, look, one of the oldest rules is that for a judge to have a discretionary ruling upheld, we have to be satisfied that he exercised discretion. Mm-hmm. Don't exercise discretion, you don't get the benefit of the abuse of discretion. And you admit, I think, after your opening, that the exercise of discretion in a case like this requires consideration of the plaintiff's ability in relation to the character.
Yes.
So if Judge Baker didn't indicate awareness of the need to consider both factors, then he didn't exercise, or we have no evidence that he actually exercised his discretion.
He did say in his order that the plaintiff's claims were such that didn't require expert counsel. I read that to say
yes, but you see, when you started off, you said the only question was the complexity of the case. Now, your description of Judge Baker's ruling suggests that he shared your misunderstanding. That is, he thought the only thing the judge has to look at is the complexity of the case, not the ability of the plaintiff.
If I said that, Judge, I misspoke, and I did not mean to say that.
Well, you said that complexity and competence are intertwined.
They're the same analysis.
You said they were the same. If complexity and competence is the same, then you only have to look at complexity, right? Because they're the same, right?
No.
If A equals 2, if A equals 2, A and 2 are interchangeable, right?
Yes, that's true.
A equals B, you don't have to worry about A. So that's how you started. And what you describe as Judge Baker's ruling is you look at the complexity of the case. If it's a simple case, that's the end.
The complexity of the case relative to the plaintiff's ability.
Is there any place where Judge Baker considered the complexity of the case in relation to the plaintiff's ability?
Because the orders he entered
all talk about complexity as an absolute rather than in relation to ability.
Yes, but there's...
And we don't know what happened during these two potentially crucial video conferences where he may have considered the plaintiff's ability.
Now we have an experienced trial judge who went through this record carefully because we have...
Do you want to answer Judge Ripple's question now?
I ask experience, not reputation.
I would like to... go ahead.
I'm sorry.
He
had entered this order where he had gone through very clearly, Judge Baker had gone through 60 pages of Mr. Pruitt's complaint. You go through 60 pages of a lot of handwritten grievances, et cetera. You get a feel for the person who's writing the grievances. And Judge Baker had that. And he also saw the gentleman. I agree, Your Honors, we don't have that to review. But when Judge Baker wrote that the case
I thought Pruitt had some assistance in writing.
He had assistance, but not in drafting the complaint, Your Honor. That was his. That was all his. He had assistance in resisting the motion.
And the complaint is what the district court describes in the record as essentially a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
But he does say that it does state several claims. He pulls them out, and he understands at that point who Mr. Pruitt is.
Let me be sure that I'm... Your view, as you stand here now, is if there are willing attorneys to try these cases, then you would be very satisfied if district courts would recruit those attorneys.
Provided it doesn't delay the proceedings, make things worse. I think in general, our trial lawyers agree that these cases often get much simpler when lawyers are brought in.
Well, what can be, as someone who tried these pro se litigants, what could be more difficult than trying a case? What is good about that process from anyone's perspective? What is better about a pro se than about a trained attorney? Why do we go to law school?
The problem is with the view that there's just an infinite number of lawyers out there to take an infinite number of prisoner cases. That certainly can't be true. At some point, the bar needs to be set somewhere.
That there are enough attorneys out there to try?
No, Judge. My point is that there are certainly not enough attorneys to handle all the pro se prisoner cases that there are.
How many go to trial?
See, that's the problem I have. Of course, we know hundreds of those cases are filed every year, probably thousands of those cases, but only a very, very small number go to trial.
1%.
So even when you look at Judge Baker's...
1% of a giant number, Judge.
When you look at Judge Baker's stats, he had 23 that he cleared. He passed the complaint. He said, you can go past step one. You can go to trial. I would dare to say that is very unusual. Obviously, my experience as a district court judge doesn't have anything to bearing in terms of statistical analysis, but I think that's extremely unusual, 23 going to trial. And if the...
that is not going to be some huge number like the number of complaints that are actually filed.
What is the ratio of prisoner pro se trials to lawyers in the...
I don't know, but I'm sure
so
there are
far less.
So
what's the business
lawyers.
About an infinite number
yes,
of trials and you don't have an infinite number of lawyers?
I said there's an infinite number of trials. I said there's an infinite number of pro se prisoners.
But the relevant question is the ratio of trials to lawyers.
I'm sure that ratio...
Well, why didn't you investigate that, if that's an important... Maybe that's not important to your argument.
I don't believe it is, except to say that if
it's
the judge knows...
It's just a throwaway point.
Well, if I could interject,
who's
the standard
protect
applies...
The lawyers from malpractice?
I'm sorry, Judge?
Who's going to protect them from any malpractice?
Well, I think that's a consideration. All of these considerations, by the way, I think are in the district court judge's expertise. That's the person on the ground making the decisions.
Judge Baker tries most of the prisoner cases.
He seems to try them from the little bit of research I did in the central
district. That's because, and he has those because of prison population in that district, right?
Yes, and I assume also maybe the courts have decided that he's the one who's very good at these type of trials. He has the expertise in this area.
And of those 23 cases that he has, how many were jury trials?
All
of them were jury trials. So I think there's also a distinction between bench trials that he tries. And I think in terms of, you know, in terms of judging competency and that kind of thing versus jury trial.
Well, there's...
You agree there's some distinction.
There's Seventh Circuit that I know that makes that distinction. I think there may be cases in other circuits that talk about jury trials being harder. That's certainly true. I can't say that that's not true, but
is that relevant?
I don't believe so, Judge.
No. That's odd.
It shouldn't.
You said complexity was so important, and complexity is relevant to procedure, right?
Perhaps the rule. Though,
I mean, how can it be that if a jury trial, as you say, is harder than a bench trial, and complexity as an index to whether an untrained person can handle a trial, then surely the fact that it's a jury trial is material to the analysis.
Yes, and I think it is material to the analysis. I also think it's material to the analysis, though, that Judge Baker is there to assist Mr. Pruitt as he goes through the trial, and I assume all the other pro se plaintiffs that go through this process. So that needs to get put into the consideration as well.
So then the rule we should have is that district judges then, it's okay if the pro se is incompetent because the district courts have the obligation to assist them in trying the case.
No, the question is whether with the assistance of the trial judge, the pro se litigant could be made to something above incompetent.
And how far does the district court judge have to go? How active does the district court have to do to make sure that the incompetence of the pro se is not a problem from a due process standpoint?
If we're looking at not his abuse of discretion before the trial, if this is the new rule that we're talking about, he has to give enough assistance to the pro se litigant so that the trial does not become a violation of due process. That does not necessarily mean appoint counsel. And that's sort of what I think happened here. Mr. Pruitt got the assistance of Judge Baker in such a way that the trial was, in fact, trial.
Well, then instead of appointing counsel, you're appointing district judge.
Well, that's a decision yes. district judges yes. make based on their experience and their discretion.
But that's what I'm saying. If that's the rule, then the district judge is like in the well of the court helping the pro se. Because if you don't want a due process violation and the person really needs a lot of assistance, then the court has to bend over backwards to assist.
At some point, that can't happen. And
that can happen, that the district court bend over.
At some point, the district court can't do that any longer. I don't believe this was that
and
clear.
And at that point, that's when you say counsel would be necessary.
Mandatory. If you reached a point where you couldn't give this person a fair trial, and if the judge has the discretion, and assuming there are lawyers to take the case, which is an assumption that the panel seems to want to make, which I'm not sure is accurate, but if there are lawyers to take the case, and if appointing one is the only way to protect the plaintiff's due process rights, then I suppose in that rare circumstance, I'd have to concede that. But that's not this case.
The district judge does also help inexperienced counsel, too, doesn't it? Not?
Yes. Federal judges have a great deal of discretion in the way they conduct their trial. It doesn't have to be the law school textbook example of, you know, this procedure, that procedure, this procedure, that procedure. The judge can take witnesses out of order, and, in fact, in this case, Judge Baker did that. He said this trial would be better if the defendants put their witnesses on first, and we did, so that the issues were better defined. That was something that we went along with. We didn't object.
You also have the problem here that
It helped you. He was bending over backwards to help you at that point.
That's not...
I mean, this poor man, he must have...
I'm not sure that our attorneys believe that, Your Honor. It was not necessarily a trial that we just walked in and said, oh, well, let's get this thing over with. I mean, at one point, at the end of the trial, the question came whether Mr. Pruitt was going to get sent back to prison, and Judge Baker said, I don't know if this jury's going to be back in 5 minutes, 5 hours, or whether they're going to hang. So he sent Mr. Pruitt back to prison. This was not a pro forma trial. My clients were on the line here.
You had logistics problems as well, didn't you? You had witnesses from the prison in addition to the plaintiff himself?
There was one witness who had a back injury, another witness, and I forget what that excuse was, but two witnesses were not in court. They testified by telephone. Your Honors?
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Anything further, Mr. Ferranti?
I would welcome any further questions the court has. Otherwise, I'll graciously return the
questions. Is our prejudice standard appropriately stated?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is the prejudice standard appropriately stated in the cases?
Yes, sir.
Do you think, well, I want to prolong this unnecessarily, but in response to this last little repartee, it seems to me if a lawyer was representing Mr. Pruitt, he would have called the defendant's witnesses first. Don't you agree?
Yeah, at the very least would have given us some serious consideration.
I mean, isn't that the way you would usually present a case like this?
I think you would, Your Honor.
So in that way, I don't think you can fairly say that he was helping the state here.
No.
Okay.
Given what you know now, the result of this trial and all the answers and various witnesses' availability and everything, what could be done with another trial?
For one thing, we would check with the four inmates who did testify and find out if they have any useful information that wasn't elicited at trial. Neither the judge nor Mr. Pruitt did much of a job at all of doing anything other than asking them point blank, did you see the assault? Did you see any conversations? Might be useful circumstantial evidence. There's also eight witnesses who weren't called. There's also the cross-examination of Mesh. Judge Baker didn't ask a single question of Officer Mesh. I think there's a lot more that could be done just with a competent examination of the plaintiff's witnesses and a cross-examination of the defense witnesses. Also, I think there would be a huge step up for Mr. Pruitt just by having somebody in the courtroom who believes his story and is there on his behalf. He starts pretty deep in the hole as an inmate in front of the jury, sitting by himself.
You're not suggesting, I take it, that a lawyer has to believe his story in order to represent him.
Not necessarily believe it, but present it as the truth,
right,
that the jury should find.
Right. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow.